This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance for Europeans and people of European descent wherever they may dwell upon the earth. And certainly this show is valuable for all people. Now, I'm very excited because I've embarked upon a new project here. I'm giving a spoken word version of Jewish supremacism, which you can receive free on this radio show over the next few days. I've already completed the preface. I've completed chapter 1 in 3 parts, and now I begin chapter 2, The Roots of Jewish Supremacism. I think you're going to find this exceedingly interesting and powerful. So let me go ahead and begin, and be sure to tell your friends about this program. Chapter 2, The Roots of Jewish Supremacism. Powerful and enigmatic, intelligent and creative, idealistic on the one hand and materialistic on the other, the Jewish people have always fascinated me. Few teenagers growing up in the middle 1960s, as I did, could have avoided acquiring a positive image of Israel and the Jewish people. Because of my years of Sunday school, my perception of the Jews was even more idealized than most. I was 11 years old when I saw the classic movie Exodus. It made such an enduring impression on me that for a few months its beautiful theme song became my favorite, one that I'd often hum or sing. I remember an episode of embarrassment when my sister and her teenage friends stumbled upon me loudly singing the stirring words, "This land is mine, God gave this land to me." Historic Israel inspired me. It was as if the Israelites of the Bible had transported themselves to modern times to live out their Old Testament adventures once again. The televised image of Israel strongly reinforced my acceptance of the idea that Gentile intolerance had caused every historical conflict with the Jewish people. After I had discovered the extensive Jewish leadership of early communism, which I had hoped was an uncharacteristic blight on Jewish history, I began to ask questions one dared not ask in polite society about this interesting people and religion. I had read about the many persecutions of the Jews throughout history, including their great suffering, now called the Holocaust. In the mid-1960s, that term had not yet been appropriated by the Jews to apply exclusively to their sufferings during the Second World War. Holocaust merely means, as it always has, large-scale destruction, especially by fire. Mark Twain wrote, "Every nation hates each other, but they all hate the Jew." Somehow, I found the impertinence to ask why. In an historical context, almost every major nation of Europe has expelled them in the past, some repeatedly, after renewed waves of Jewish immigration. What was it, I wondered, about the Jewish people that inspired such hatred? Normally, when we study historical conflicts between nations or peoples, we do it dispassionately. For instance, in examining any war from long ago, we list as objectively as possible the grievances and rationales of the opposing sides. When studying the war for Southern independence, every American schoolchild learns the Southern arguments for secession and the Northern arguments for forced union. In contrast, when studying the many historical disputes between the Jewish people and others, only the Jewish point of view is acceptable. In early 1995, Congressman Newt Gingrich, Speaker of the House, fired his newly appointed congressional librarian, Christina Jeffrey. He fired her for having once suggested that history students, when studying the Holocaust, should also study the German point of view on the subject. She was fired in spite of her high standing in her profession and notwithstanding her long and cozy relations with powerful Jewish ADL, Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. The very suggestion that there could be another side to any issue affecting Jews is decried as anti-Semitic. In both the entertainment and news media, the only permissible opinion is that Jews are always innocent victims persecuted by intolerant Christians and other, quote, anti-Semites, unquote. Maybe they were always innocent, and all the other peoples of the world were always unjust, I thought. But they weren't so innocent in the Russian Revolution. I realized I could not evaluate the issue fairly until I had read both sides. One of the first things I discovered was that while Gentiles who called the Jews a, quote, race are condemned, Jewish leaders have for centuries routinely called their people a race. The foremost leader of American Jewry in the 1930s, Rabbi Stephen F. Wise, said it succinctly in his dramatic statement, quote, Hitler was right in one thing, he calls the Jewish people a race, and we are a race. Right up to the present day, there are many statements illustrating how Jewish leaders matter-of-factly view themselves not just as a religion, but as an identifiable race, genetically distinguishable from other peoples. Noam Goldman, one of the leading Jews of the 20th century and former president of the World Jewish Organization, said it very bluntly, quote, Jews are divided into two categories, those who admit they belong to a race distinguished by a history thousands of years old and those who don't. The latter are open to the charge of dishonesty, unquote. The former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, speaking to a Jewish group in Southern California, said, quote, if Israel had not come into existence after the World War II, then I am certain the Jewish race wouldn't have survived. I stand before you and say you must strengthen your commitment to Israel. An editorial entitled, quote, Some Other Race in the New York Weekly Forward, a very prestigious Jewish publication, urges Jews to list themselves on U.S. government census forms as a race. It goes on to suggest, quote, on the question 8 of the form which asks about race, you might consider doing what more than one member of our Radetzka editorial staff has done, checking the box Some Other Race and writing the word Jew. Charles Bronfman, a main sponsor of the 210 million Birthright Israel organization, specifically an organization committed to preserving Jewish bloodlines, Jewish genetic heritage, and preventing intermarriage between Jews and Gentiles, express the need to preserve the Jewish genetic character as expressed in the Jewish DNA. Now, Bronfman is the brother of Edgar Bronfman, Sr., president of the World Jewish Congress, and this is what he said, quote, you're losing a lot, losing the kind of feeling you have when you know that throughout the world there are people who somehow or other have the same kind of DNA that you have. He's talking about Jews who intermarry. Now imagine for a moment if President George Bush would speak to a group of white college students and tell them how great it is for them to know that others in the world share their white DNA and that they would lose it by intermarrying with other races. Now Bush could live 100 years and still never live down a remark like that. During his campaign for president in 2000, Bush spoke before dozens of Jewish organizations and synagogues that oppose intermarriage between Jews and non-Jews. The media had only praise for those appearances. In contrast, Bush faced universal criticism by the Jewish media by simply speaking at a conservative Christian university, Bob Jones University, that quietly opposes racial intermarriage. After the media unleashed a storm of criticism, Bush had to quickly apologize and then passionately condemned Bob Jones University for its position. Of course, within a few days, Bush was again speaking before many Jewish groups that stridently oppose intermarriage of Jews and non-Jews. Yet no one in the media dared object to these appearances, or even bothered to point out this blatant double standard. Looking for answers to the Jewish view on race, I returned to where I'd first learned my respect for the Jews in the Holy Bible. I went back and reread the Old Testament, paying close attention to the relationships between Jews and non-Jews. In contrast to the universalism of the New Testament, the Old Testament is extremely ethnocentric. It repeatedly identifies the Israelites as a, quote, special people or a chosen people, and it painstakingly traces the genealogical descent of the children of Israel. Many thought-provoking passages forbid the intermarriage of Jews and other tribes. In the book of Exodus, Moses responds to Israelites who had sexual relations with Moabite women by ordering that the Moabites be executed. In Ezra, God commanded those who married non-Israelites to cast off their wives and even the children of such unions. And some of the bloodiest writings I've ever read detail the Jewish people's annihilation of their tribal enemies. The massacres of Canaanites, Jacobites, Philistines, Egyptians, and dozens of other peoples are gruesomely recorded in the Bible. In today's terminology, we describe the slaughter of entire peoples as genocide. Old Testament Jews spared neither men, women, children, or even the animals and pets of their enemies. The following are just a few among dozens of similar passages found in the Old Testament. From Joshua 6:21, "And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass, with the edge of the sword." 10:32-34, "Then Horam, king of Gezer, came to help Lachish, and Joshua smote him and all his people until he had left him none remaining. And they took Eglon and smote it with the edge of the sword, and all the souls that were therein." And Joshua 10:37, "And they took Hebron and smote it with the edge of the sword, and the king thereof, and all the cities thereof, and the souls that were therein. He left none remaining." And Isaiah 34:2-3, "For the indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. He hath utterly destroyed them, he hath delivered them to the slaughter. Their slain also shall be cast out, and their stink shall come up out of their carcasses, and the mountains shall be melted in their blood." And Deuteronomy 20:16, "But in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God gives you for your inheritance, you shall save nothing alive that breathes." Now, my friends, as a Christian, I could not explain what appeared to be celebrations of genocide. I acknowledged that God is unfathomable and unknowable. However, I could not help but have sympathy for those who were massacred, including the thousands of innocent men, women, and children. It's easy to imagine how the few who survived those bloody, merciless massacres felt about, quote, the Jews. Of course, the ancient Jews were not unique in their pursuit of ethnic cleansing. Many other early peoples had committed genocide on their enemies. With the coming of Jesus Christ and his advocacy of love and kindness as recorded in the New Testament, the Old Testament advocacy and record of genocide is little recollected by modern churches. When a modern Christian stumbles upon such passages in the Old Testament condoning genocide, he usually dismisses them as the sad happenings of a remote biblical era, one now mitigated with the new covenant of love that Christ brings to those who accept his message. The Israelite record on racial integrity and supremacy is quite clear. And let's quote, "Neither shalt thou make messages with them, their daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. For thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God has chosen thee a special people unto himself above all people that are on the face of the earth." Deuteronomy 7:6. "Now therefore give not your daughters unto their sons, neither take their daughters unto your sons, nor seek the peace or their wealth forever, that ye may be strong and eat of the good of the land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever." Inheritance to your children forever. That's Ezra 9:12. Members of racial groups might argue about their comparative history or abilities or spirituality, but to suggest that God favors one people over all others, even to the point of advocating and condoning genocide to make way for the chosen, certainly that must be the apex of racial supremacy. Modern Christianity deals with the ethnocentric and genocidal parts of the Old Testament by focusing on the loving aspects of the New Testament. One example is the way that Jesus Christ reversed Old Testament law, such as an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, to turn the other cheek. The Jewish religion, however, had no comparable figure in its history to moderate the extreme ethnocentrism of the Old Testament. Perhaps the Jewish teacher who offered the greatest moderation toward Gentiles was Maimonides, considered by most Jews as the foremost figure of European Judaism. Even Maimonides decreed that Jewish physicians, though, should not save the life of a Christian unless not saving him would, quote, cause the spread of hostility against the Jews, unquote. And again, for these passages, you can get all the documentation and the citations from my book, Jewish Supremacism. The early spread of Christianity by the Apostle Paul encouraged Christians to become more tolerant of different ethnic groups. Paul himself was Jewish. A Pharisee who converted to Christianity and preached much of his life to the Gentiles of diverse nationalities. The Christian faith had intolerance for other beliefs and other gods, but no bias against other tribes. Evangelists of the ancient world themselves came from assorted peoples and preached across the known world. Of course, Christians could, and often did, harbor xenophobic tendencies, but their nationalistic or ethnocentric attitudes found their origins in their own cultures, not in the teachings of the New Testament. The book of Galatians makes the point quite well that the chosen people is neither Jew nor Greek, and are now those who accept the salvation of Jesus Christ. Salvation in the ancient world became based on acceptance of faith and not simply by possession of certain blood. The Christian religion had an evolution then quite different than that of the Jewish religion. The Jewish people and their religion are and were entwined. Belief in God was necessary to preserve the tribe as much as preserving the tribe was important to safeguarding their religion. However, according to the Jewish state of Israel, race is far more important than religious belief. A prospective immigrant to Israel does not have to practice or believe in Judaism to immigrate to Israel. In fact, he can be an outspoken atheist and a communist for that matter. He must only prove Jewish descent. Protection of the ethnic identity of the Jewish people became the main reason for Judaism's existence. In the Middle East and later throughout the world, the Jews mingled with many peoples, and yet they preserved their heritage and their essential customs. They are the only ethnic minority in Western nations that is not assimilated after thousands of years. In Babylon, they lived under slavery and then under domination for hundreds of years and developed a code that enabled them not only to survive, but to prosper while living as a minority in an alien society. When they emerged from their Babylonian sojourn, they were stronger, more organized, and more ethnocentric than ever before. In rejecting Jesus Christ and the love and tolerance he preached, Judaism proceeded on its path of chauvinism. It culminated in the pages of the Talmud, an encyclopedic exposition of Jewish law and custom compiled by hundreds of rabbis over the centuries. The American Heritage Dictionary describes it as, quote, constituting the basis of religious authority for traditional Judaism. The Talmud was first transcribed in Babylonian times, and the oral tradition is many centuries older. By the 6th century AD, it was written down, becoming the most important religious work of the Jewish people and the chief canon of their religion. In it, they finally codified their most chauvinistic tendencies. Hermann Wouk, the very famous Jewish writer, describes the influence of the Talmud as follows. The Talmud is to this day the circulating heart's blood of the Jewish religion. Whatever laws, customs, or ceremonies we observe, whether we are Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, or merely spasmodic sentimentalists, we follow the Talmud. It is our common law. As a 16-year-old, during one of my visits to the Citizens Council offices, I had found a book called The Jewish Religion, Its Influence Today. It was by Elizabeth Dilling. It interested me because the large format of the book contained complete photocopied pages from parts of the Talmud, officially compiled by Jewish scholars, an English translation of that which was published by Jewish rabbinical societies. Now, I remember skipping Dilling's commentary and going right to the translations. One of the first passages I read really surprised me. It said, quote, a heathen, Gentile, who pries into the Torah and other Jewish scriptures is condemned to death, for it's written, it is our inheritance not theirs. Now, if a 16-year-old boy reads something forbidden like that, he is certainly bound to read on. The passage was completely alien to everything I'd always understood about religion. Why would they not want all men to read their holy words the same way Christians want to spread the good news? Just what is it in these scriptures that would oblige the Jews to kill a Gentile that read them? Why would public knowledge of Jewish scriptures be dangerous to Jews? I went to the library and found some old translations of parts of the Talmud. It was not long before I came across another, even more amazing passage, such as, quote, Balaam, Jesus, is raised from the dead and being punished in boiling hot semen. Those who mock the words of the Jewish sages and sin against Israel are boiled in hot excrement. That's from 57a Gittin. Now, when I asked my Jewish friend's rabbi about the passage, he told me that Balaam was not Jesus. Now, he sounded pretty convincing. But that very evening, I looked up Balaam in the Jewish encyclopedia and was shocked to read that Balaam was a pseudonym for Jesus. Because Christian scholars periodically obtained copies of the Talmud, Talmudic scribes hoped to deceive them by using the name Balaam to denote Jesus. In the Jewish encyclopedia, under the heading Balaam, it says, and I quote, the pseudonym Balaam, given to Jesus in Sanhedrin 106b and Gittin 57a. Again, that quote, Balaam is raised from the dead and being punished in boiling hot semen. The Talmud repeatedly uses obscure words to denote Gentiles with an assortment of names such as Egyptian, heathen, Kuthian, idolater. In the most popular English language translation of the Talmud, called the Cicino edition, the practice is often illustrated by the fifth footnote of the Book of Sanhedrin. That footnote reads, quote, Kuthian, Samaritan, was here substituted for the original Goy. Yeah, that's Christians are sometimes referred to by the code word men or minim. Now, the footnotes of the Cicino edition of Talmud, as well as passages in the Jewish encyclopedia, blatantly mention this intentional artifice. The Encyclopedia Judaica also notes that, quote, in rabbinical literature, the distinction between Gentile, Goy, Akam, and Christian, Naziri, has frequently been obscured by textual alterations necessitated by the vigilance of censors. Thus, Egyptian, Amalekite, Zadokite, Sadducee, and Kuti, Samaritan, often stands in place of the original Nazari, as well as Goy, Akam, etc. Probably when Resh Lashvi stated that a Gentile, Akam, in existing texts, who observed the Sabbath, is punishable by death, Sanhedrin 58b, he had in mind Christians. Numerous anti-Christian polemic passages only make real sense after Naziri has been restored in place of the spurious Kuti or Zadokite. Now, in other passages of the Talmud, I discovered a possible reason why some of the Talmud's writers had forbidden Gentiles to read it. And I'll let you listen to these passages. And maybe you can realize, maybe you can decide for yourself why they don't want Gentiles to read this book. Only Jews are human. Gentiles are animals. That's from Baba Mazia 114a, 114b. For murder, whether of a Kuthian Gentile by a Kuthian or of an Israelite by a Kuthian, punishment is incurred. But of a Kuthian by an Israelite, there is no death penalty. Sanhedrin 57a. Even the best of the Gentiles should be killed, Babylonian Talmud. If a Jew is tempted to do evil, he should go to a city where he's not known and do the evil there, Moed Katan 17a. Gentiles' flesh is as the flesh of asses, and whose issue is like the issue of horses. If a heathen, Gentile, hits a Jew, the Gentile must be killed. Hitting a Jew is hitting God. Now, that sounds a little bit like idolatry to me, my friends. If an ox of an Israelite gores the ox of a Canaanite, there is no liability. But if an ox of a Canaanite, Gentile, gores an ox of an Israelite, the payment must be made in full. Baba Kema, 37b. If a Jew finds an object lost by a heathen Gentile, it does not have to be returned. Baba Mezia 24a, affirmed also in Baba Kamma 113b. God will not spare a Jew who marries his daughter to an old man or takes a wife for his infant son or returns a lost article to a Kuthian, a Gentile. Sanhedrin 76a. What a Jew obtains by theft from a Kuthian, Gentile, he may keep. Sanhedrin 57a. Gentiles are outside the protection of the law, and God has exposed their money to Israel. Baba Kamma 37b. Jews may use lies, subterfuges, to circumvent a Gentile. Baba Kamma 13a. All Gentile children are animals. Yabamoth 98a. Gentiles prefer sex with cows. Abdora Zera 22a, 22b. The vessels of Gentiles, do they not impart a worsened flavor to the food cooked in them? Abdora Zera 67b. It astonished me to read such unmitigated hatred from the chief writings of the Jewish religion. It was obvious that these quotations were all authentic because the copies I had read were published by Jewish organizations. I could not find any rational explanation of such writings being in the Jewish sacred books. In fact, it became clear to me that most Americans don't even know that such writings even exist. Since the publishing of my autobiography, My Awakening, the ADL and other organizations have criticized my characterization of the Talmud as anti-Gentile and that Balaam was the Jewish moniker for Jesus Christ. They refuted through typical Talmudic prevarication. They quote obscure passages and have scholars make interpretations that serve their argument, but they don't dare to quote their own major historical Jewish publications that interpret the Talmud exactly the same way that I do. The Jewish Encyclopedia, compiled by dozens of major rabbinic organizations from all over the world, says the Talmud makes clear that Balaam is Jesus and that Gentiles are not men. The anti-Gentile Talmudic quotes were at first hard for me to believe, as they will be for many readers. However, if anyone doubts their authenticity, an easy way to verify the Talmud's extreme hatred against Gentiles is by reading the Jewish Encyclopedia. In the very article, Gentiles, it makes clear the Talmud's clear hatred toward non-Jews. Under the subtitle, Discrimination Against Gentiles, on pages 617 to 621, it clearly shows the Talmud's attitude toward non-Jews. Here are some excerpts. They held that only Israelites are men. Gentiles they classed not as men, but as barbarians. Another reason for the discrimination was the vile and vicious character of the Gentiles, whose flesh is like the flesh of asses and issues like the issue of horses. And this goes on and on. The presumption is that Gentiles obtain possession by seizure. He withdrew protection of shining legal protection from Gentiles' property rights. And Gentiles' property is considered public property like the unclaimed land in the desert. Now, the 1907 edition of the Funk and Wagnalls Jewish Encyclopedia mentions a quotation of Rabbi Simon ben Yoha, a giant of Talmudic literature. And that quotation is often quoted by anti-Semites. The quotation reads, and they point that out, Tob shibi goyim harag. The best of the goyim is to be killed. Now, it says this anti-Gentile statement was a reaction of a rabbi whose life experiences may furnish an explanation for his animosity. Yet the passage continues revealingly. In the connection in which it stands, the import of this observation is similar to that of two others. The most pious woman is addicted to sorcery, and the best of snakes ought to have its head crushed. Now, the Talmudic quotations I reproduce here are by no means taken out of context. It's true that the Talmud is comprised of many writings and has many commentaries throughout. It also sometimes actually has disputes on certain issues. However, there is no mistaking. There is absolutely no mistaking the decidedly anti-Gentile tone that dominates the Talmud throughout it. The exhortation, for instance, that the best of Gentiles should be killed is located in at least three different sections. Now imagine for a moment if a prominent Christian pronounced that, quote, the best of the Jews should be killed. Would not such a statement be forcefully condemned? Imagine the media opprobrium that would be heaped upon the offending words and its author. Perversely, if one exposes the intolerance of the Talmud, the one who exposes the intolerance of the Talmud is the one likely to face accusations of religious prejudice and intolerance. Ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of part one, and we will definitely continue with this chapter, chapter two, The Roots of Jewish Supremacism, on tomorrow's program. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope that you do your best to get this program out to as many people around your neighborhood, around your city, and around your world. Thanks so much, and I look forward to being with you tomorrow. Bye-bye now.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddu.com.